What can I tell you? Okay, 1 second. Let me make a note here. Plus Rabbi Avishai David. All right, let's begin. I have a world to do. I imagine there'll be a few more stragglers coming in. Problem is, as those statement of Lange Shmon Esrei, and they begin late. If they begin early, Mela, they can stand along Shmon Esrei, but to begin late. And,
it takes longer. You've got to sit at the Shepherd
Yeah. All right.
You told once the story of Ron Cutler and the student who lost.
No, I can tell you the student was Rabbi Moshe David Tendler's younger brother, who later became the he's the one who introduced Chalav Yisrael to Baltimore. He established the firm, and he ran the high school dormitory of Talmudical Academy. If I have it right, he was in Baltimore all his years. And Rabbi Aaron once went over to him and told him, "I'm schuldig, aber halt als du stehst zu lang a Shmon Esrei." That could only happen in a Litvish yeshiva. It couldn't happen in a Hasidic setting. Okay, today is September the 16th, 2019. And I say, Boker Tov Mevorach to the students in front of me. It's a big week here in Israel. Tomorrow, Yom HaGadol V'Hanora, and I hope we'll be laughing on Wednesday and not crying. My educated guesses will be laughing, and a lot of people have asked me who to vote for. I'm not a Hasidic Rebbe, but I tell my own family too, so I tell everyone I don't vote for the Likud. Everyone has this idea we need a big right-wing party. And my problem with the Likud is they will not be mechallel Shabbos, but they will not fight the Shabbos. Whereas if you vote one of the religious parties, and here we're limited, it's either Agudat Yisrael or Ayelet Shaked, what became of the religious Zionist party. To vote for any other party, you run the terrible risk of Chas v'Chalila wasting your vote. So I'm voting for Ayelet Shaked, but my dear friend, Rav David Chai Kohen, you know, there's an Adam Gadol. He's the Rav, the Sfadik Rav of Bat Yam. And he's a son-in-law to Reb, he's a grandson-in-law to Reb Lezer Silver. It's the first wedding I attended in Israel more than 50 years ago when we were Olim Chadashim. And he married Reb Lezer's granddaughter, Rav David Silver's daughter. And he came out to vote for Agudat Yisrael, and he's a Merkaz HaRavnik 100%. He did Hesder in KBY. He was at Sanchan. He later did Merkaz HaRav many years, and he came out to vote for Agudat Yisrael. And the worst part is that I can understand him. Rakefir has lived in Israel more than 50 years. He can understand why someone says that he talked for Agudat Yisrael. Charlie has tzaris because his Rebbe, he came out not to vote. You know what I'm talking about. Where did you go after high school? No, tell the class. Don't be. After high school.
Kol Torah.
Kol Torah. And who was your Rebbe there? You told me he's an Adam Gadol, Rabbi Deitch, right or wrong?
No, I never liked Deitch, no.
You didn't ever have him as a Rebbe, but you knew him.
Yeah.
You told me he's an Adam Gadol, and he came out not to vote. So, in my estimation, Father Chabnishke Zotman, Adam Gadol, let's keep it quiet. All right, and I want to say hello to all those listening across the wide expanse of the Jewish universe. Now, coming back to lectures that we gave years ago, if you recall, we spoke about Rabbi Harry Epstein of Atlanta, Georgia. Rabbi Harry Epstein is a case study of someone who began the biggest yichus in the world. He studied in Hebron. His uncle was Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Hebron Rosh Yeshiva, the Lislabatka Rosh Yeshiva, and his father was Rav Ephraim Epstein, the most famous Rav in Chicago, and he ultimately became a conservative rabbi. And as you recall, I brought some sources, theories that later in life he regretted it, and now I have a direct quote from him that appeared in Atlanta, Georgia newspaper, June of 1988, I think a Talmud sent it to me, asked what he did not accomplish and pauses for a moment. This is just after he retired. I haven't succeeded in deepening Jewish awareness. A Jew doesn't know what he is. There's great ignorance in the community, and the leadership, unfortunately, is not of the caliber to improve things. In part, he blames his own retreat, much to my regret, from orthodoxy. I've lost my taste for conservative Judaism, he says bleakly. So I think that settles the issue. An interesting comment from Rabbi Mike Schatz. As you recall, we spoke about a lot of Jews run away to Long Beach or ran away to Long Beach in the summer, and at times they would have Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur services there. And outside of Boston, in Onset, was the same story, that people ran to Onset. Then there's a shul that was established in the Rav's time. It's open all summer and open on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur as well. The couple that now runs it have become my machatanim. So we have gone there to spend Rosh Hashanah with the kids the last few years. A couple of years ago, when Rosh Hashanah was Thursday and Friday, he asked me to give a drasha and Shabbos tshuva. I used the Rambam that was in the shul, and it was an old one. I looked for the title page to see if it was old enough that the Rav may have used it. On the front piece, there was a dedication in memory of Rebbetzin Tanya from, quote, the Talmidim of Rabbeinu Shlita, end quote. Incidentally, when we got to lunch after that, my wife said it was a good drasha, but she had never heard me use the phrase willy-nilly before. Until she said that, I had not been aware I had used the phrase, but the Rebbe, referring to me, will surely know where it came from. And here is to Jack, there was a podcast that's, I don't know what I'm talking about, a podcast, a schmodcast. I'm just repeating words that I'm told.
Who wrote the piece about
Onset? Mike Schatz. You can have it after class. I don't know who it is. It's a sub-student. And Schatz, he's, the person running the shul today is his mechutin. So you can figure it out from that. So there's a Rabbi Lichtenstein, as far as I call very successful, if he's a businessman or in high finance, and he's one of the big stars in the greater OU galaxy. And he has a broadcast where he discusses contemporary Torah issues. He's put out a number of books. I've never met him, but I'm quite impressed with what I see. And it seems they had a debate. One broadcast and another. One was a Litvak and one was a Chassid, and there was a lot of protest afterwards. And I'm quoting, the point I would like to make is as follows. The Rebbe's chinuch, referring to Lubavitcher Rebbe, isn't just Ahavat Yisrael and saving the Jewish world from assimilation. It is much more than that, and I feel that more notice has to be made of this. Walking away from the last podcast, the maskana was that many came away with the feeling that Chabad puts Ahavas Yisrael before Torah, and the Litvisher Welt puts Torah before Ahavat Yisrael. And you see, that's exactly what we're referring to. Where do you strike the balance? And there's no question on the galaxy of Jews living out there and doing and trying today, there's some who put more stress on Lima Torah, and there's some that put more stress on putting tefillin on lulav and etrog, and all that goes with Chabad. And that comes back to the whole question we're dealing with on Sunday. How do you relate to people that you want to invite to shul, you want to invite to your home, and then Mechalalai Shabbos? Imagine what we ended off the class with yesterday, that you invite a Jew who just got out of Russia, and he takes out his violin and serenades you with Shalom Aleichem, the one Jewish song he knows how to play on the violin. How do you react? All right, we dealt with that yesterday. All right, let me move further. Today's shiur is very fascinating, and we're going back in time. You're an Avalov? Who's this gentleman sitting there? Yeah. That's your friend?
It's Mr. Avalo.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So come close if you don't hear. There's plenty of room here. There's no problem. Your daughter, the sweet taste of teaching your daughter a lifetime ago is still in my mouth. Okay, Esther. All right, let's roll. It's very fascinating. We're talking about Rabbi Lookstein, Joseph Lookstein. We're talking about the precedent, the antecedent, what happened before him. And he was the last of the big three Rabbanim. He was a bit younger than both Rabbis Goldstein and Rabbi Young. It's the last of the big three. Where was he coming from? And as we mentioned last week, he married the right girl. He married Gertrud Schlang. Gertrud Schlang was the granddaughter of Ramaz. All right? Ramaz always needed an English-speaking rabbi. And you had Mordechai Kaplan. You had Herbert S. Goldstein. And then you had Joseph Lookstein. And being Ramaz's grandson-in-law, it was a perfect union. Spiritually, physically, he was there to stay. He didn't move on. He was fulfilled. And in the 1910s, you saw the tremendous problem that haunts us and haunted us, the lack of unity. There were now hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of East European Jews in the great New York area. The old timers from the German Jews who now were totally acculturated and totally part of the American scene, they wanted to bring unity. And they came up with the idea of the Kehillah. And I'm going to quote from a volume, Arthur Gorin. I've never met him. I hope he's still alive. He was born in the 1920s. He was like one of us, partial American, partial Israeli. He taught at Hebrew U. He taught at Columbia University. I don't know where his children are. The ultimate, the Rakefet litmus test is, where are the children? That way you look 50, 70, 80 years later, 100 years later, and you see where the kids are, so you know whether the Israeli genes went out or the American genes. He was born into a Zionist home, but not religious, had tremendous Israeli feeling. He attended Teachers Institute of Yeshiva University at one point, later does his PhD, gets a degree from Hebrew U, PhD at Columbia, and his PhD thesis was on the Kehillah. It's a very fascinating piece of work. And here you see the German Jews want to bring unity. In order to bring unity, two tremendous tasks are facing them. One, organizing decent Talmud Torahs, decent schools with lighting, with textbooks, with curriculum, with good teachers. Two, kashrut. And these two challenges became the undoing of the Kehillah. It survived about 10 years on paper, constant machloket. As I explained last week, Rabbi Margolis, Rabbi Ramaz, was very open-minded. He and Rabbi Philip Hillel Klein of the Upper West Side, the Hungarian congregation, Ohed Tzedek, Ramaz and Rabbi Klein, very open-minded, willing to cooperate. They wanted veto power. They didn't want the German Jews to interfere with curriculum, but they were willing to cooperate. They understood the necessity. A man with exactly the same name, Rabbi Gabriel Zev Margolis, was the biggest opponent, and this is the machloket that lives on in Tul today. How do we relate to Jacob Schiff? How do we relate to Louis Marshall? How do we relate to Cyrus Adler? How do we relate to Jews who are no longer totally observant, but yet care about Yiddishkeit? How do we relate to conservative rabbis? How do we relate to reform rabbis? But what's important is Ramaz was broad. He was willing to cooperate. And this explains Rabbi Lookstein to you. Rabbi Lukstein, years later, was one of the leading voices against the Rashi Yeshiva, against the Cherem on Synagogue Council, against the Cherem on the Rabbinical belonging to a New York Board of Rabbis. He inherited this attitude from his grandfather. Now, I just want to show you some of the charges that were made, so you should get a feel of what was happening. I have no doubt that the Reform Jews who were involved meant l'shem shemayim. I have no doubt they were trying their best to compromise. They understood that they can't take over Hashgacha, but they wanted organization, they wanted honesty. Jacob Schiff was a legendary figure. As I've told you 1,000 times over, there are endless anecdotes about Jacob Schiff, caught between two worlds. Again, I quote him, "You can only be a good Reform Jew if you were raised as an Orthodox Jew." That's a quote from Jacob Schiff. And he was one of the people who put heavy money into this. And the machloket went on and on. Now, what are we talking about, the machloket? What do we mean? What are they saying? What are they complaining about? And here you have an example that they claim that one of the principles that they want to bring into the Talmud Torah system was a missionary in Eastern Europe before he reached America. In other words, these are pretty serious charges. Can you prove it? A missionary. Talmud Torah, Samson Benderly, the name I mentioned last week, this person functioned under Samson Benderly. And the Rabbanim were yelling and shouting. I need not tell you, when you make a charge like that, people respond, people get angry. It poisons the atmosphere. And these were one of the real problems. We'll never know. I'm not doing the research, but our friend Arthur Gorin, who did the research, doesn't reach a conclusion. He's just telling you what was happening. And here you see time and again, I'll quote to you from an article in the Morgenjournal, which was the religious daily Yiddish newspaper. They claimed that these people trying to take over education made a show of the Torah and our holy prophets. They changed the spiritual giants into moving picture heroes. From some Gentile artists, they borrowed an Isaiah and a Yirmiyahu and projected them onto a bedsheet. One without a hat, second without a beard, but with a shaved mustache, exactly like a genuine Yankee sport. Okay? Do you understand what this is talking about? Here, they took, what's a bedsheet, no? We forgot already, when you used to show a movie, you had to have a screen. No, if you didn't have a screen, you took a bedsheet, you put it up on the wall, and you showed the movie, you showed the slides. Nowadays, we have computers, we have screens, we're living a totally different world, Ellie. But do you still remember bedsheets? You don't remember. I remember. And they're showing pictures, probably a Rembrandt, a portrait. No, do they paint them with kippot? Did they wear kippot? That's a different question. Where does the kippot begin? A beard, Ribbono Shel Olam, without beards, new without beards. Nowadays, what can I tell you? We'll take a survey in the rabbis of the 1940s, the 1950s, the 1960s. How many had beards and how many didn't have beards? I still remember in 1957, Eric Zimmer, right after class, the Rebbe sitting, you know where I'm sitting, and Eric comes over, and I was sitting right here, and Eric, I heard the whole conversation, Eric says, Rebbe, Eric, everyone know who I'm talking about? Professor Yitzchak Zimmer of Bar Ilan University, retired today. He's a Talmud of YU. Fine Talmud Chacham, Yerei Shemayim, a Yeki. He's of German origins, Eric Zimmer. Eric comes over to the Rebbe. Rebbe, are you allowed to shave Cholamoid? And the Rebbe says, tell me, what is your practice? How often do you shave? Every day. Do you shave Erev Yontif? He says, yes. So why can't you shave Chol HaMoed? What are you, an Avelet? You're in mourning? You understand? I don't need not tell you what the Rav said. Rav Moshe, Rav Feinstein, their endless tshuva. It all goes back to the Noda Behuda's famous tshuva. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank wrote on it. Rav Ovadia Yosef wrote on this little problem. Can you shave Chol HaMoed? All right. But you see the Rav's attitude. Not to shave? You're an Avelet. Well, what do you mean not to shave Chol HaMoed? And here they're complaining. These are the Rabbanim, Agudas Rabbanim, this is Velvu Margolis, pictures of Yirmiyahu on a bedsheet, pictures of Yeshayahu without a hat, without a beard, with a shaved mustache, exactly like a Yankee sport. So you see, you can get a feeling why ultimately this was insurmountable. And by the mid-1900s already, the propositions couldn't get off the floor. The Magen Shaul brought proof to the head of the whole Kehila, Professor Rabbi Judah Magnus, who himself was an interesting individual. I told you, he was a Reform rabbi, rabbi of Temple Emmanuel at one time. And he was a Shemesh Shabbos when he came in Aliyah to Israel, where he became head of the Hebrew University. Magnus Press is named in his memory. He davened in the shtivel. And they brought the proof that a bureau school head, I mean, he's one of the Talmud Torahs functioning under the Bureau of Jewish Education of the Kehillah, had served in Europe as a Christian missionary. They had brought the information to Magnus, but to no avail. So this was an attempt. It did not succeed. It had one great achievement, which every scholar in the world has to thank them for. I believe I've mentioned this over the generations. They did publish a one volume. It's a volume, the only volume I ever bought at auction. I think I must be the early 70s. It was auctioned off in London from some famous rabbi had died and he left a fortune of books. I think I paid the equivalent of $10 for it. It's a volume of over 1,000 pages of all the rabbis, presidents of shuls, all the shuls, the temples, all the schools. It's a total description. It's like a photograph of what greater New York City was like 100 years ago. And that book is invaluable. If you read my seventh book, Washington, you'll see that in Washington, I described the shuls on Washington Avenue where I grew up. Where did I get all that information? There's no shul left standing there. The neighborhood is, you won't find a Jew. It's a sakanat nefesha to walk there by day, let alone at night. And where did I get all that info? From this volume. But you see, already by the 1910s, you had a group of Orthodox Rabbanim and a group of lay people who were observant, who cared about Torah, but they were more at home in America. They were willing to deal with Magnus, with Jacob Schiff, with Louis Marshall, with Cyrus Adler. They were more at home. They weren't as frightened and overwhelmed by the American scene. They could handle it. Something is developing here. The Joint Distribution Committee, remember we spoke years ago about what happened in World War I. World War I woke up the Jews and America became the center of the Jewish world until the State of Israel took over, a result of World War I. And the Joint Distribution Committee, in the famous picture, you see the Balabatim, Reform, conservative, and there you see Rabbi Aaron Teitelbaum with a long Hasidish beard, with a bekesha. You see other leaders with kippah on their heads. A new element is slowly but surely developing. And we'll come back to that. All right. Now, remember what I've said all along. Nothing is better than memoir literature. Because memoir literature does not lie. When people ask yours truly, you know, you're a rabbi, you have a little influence, So people think you have magical powers. I remember the Rebbe saying more than once, Ellie, you with me, or I have to translate from ancient Chinese? If I say something in ancient Chinese, just raise your hand, I'll translate. The Rebbe would say, one thing I can tell you, I don't have Ruach HaKodesh. You follow? So they think Rabbanim have Ruach HaKodesh. So they'll say to you, Rebbe, what's going to happen on Tuesday? Okay? You're going to get that question. What's going to happen on Tuesday? Well, I'll know on Wednesday morning when I turn the radio on what's going to happen on Tuesday. But when people ask me, what happened? I get all these questions on Jewish history, Torah history. And many times, all I can say is, I cannot tell you for sure what happened. I'm trying to predict the past. Okay, Dov underlined the word. I'm trying to predict the past. Okay? Now, memoir literature is wonderful because there it's not a prediction. It's what the person actually felt. When you read Washington, it's not Rakefet predicting the past. He's telling you what he felt, how he was influenced, what his feelings were. When you write history 1,000 years from now, you can write, there was a guy named Rakefet who attended Yeshiva University, and this is the way he felt, and this is the influence it had upon him. That's absolutely accurate. You don't like the way Rakefet felt? Fine. But that's the way he felt. It's his memoir. What's beautiful about memoir literature, you can capture an era, the influence it has. You're not predicting now. Now, I want to thank a Talmud, a sub-Talmud, David Sapir. He sent me, and it's amazing, I remember reading this when it originally came out. I believe it was 1953, if I can see correctly, I believe so. It appeared in New Yorker magazine, and it was called The Daughter of the Ramaz by S.N. Berman, and Berman, the last name of the person was Berman. And what happened, this lady's uncle married the Ramaz's daughter. And she writes a beautiful memoir of the period. And I just want to quote part of it to you. Part of it is simply interesting. It captures Ramaz. Part of it will need, we're going to come back to when it becomes very important, because this is a very accurate source. I'll stress it when I reach it. Now, she writes that about the time I was born, a radiant event took part in my family. And she describes that she, her family, East European immigrants, she was born in America, and they lived in Worcester, Massachusetts. And they were nice, from people, Jews, trying to become part of the American scene. And then something happened. In 1893, a total unexpected engagement of my Uncle Harry, who lived a couple of blocks away on Providence Street, to a girl named Ida, the daughter of the Ramaz. And you can read the memoir, it's probably online, it's a Chashuva publication, The New Yorker, and this lady evidently knew how to write, beautiful, beautiful writing, and she describes her aunt, married to her uncle, and they now moved to New York. She kept house for her father, and the Ramaz was married once, married a second time, married a third time, and she even makes a fourth shidduch for the Ramaz. Women died young then, life was much harder, childbirth, so many women died. I went to school with so many kids whose mothers were really their aunts. Are you aware of that? There was Minig Yisrael that if a young woman died in childbirth, her youngest sister would marry the widow. Madov, do you ever remember that? Did your father ever tell you that? Your uncle? Ellie, you never heard of it, believe me. But this was Minig Yisrael. It was Mamish and Minhag, because they felt a sister, an aunt, would raise the child like her own. She would have that love for the child that was her late sister's child. So he had four wives, and She had a tremendous sense of humor. She writes about he would get shilas, a woman called to ask him, and whether she served her family a chicken she had reason to believe had not been killed according to ritual. And the Ramaz had to tell her, I cannot possibly examine a chicken over the phone. Mm-hmm. You follow? She wanted an answer with the chicken over the phone. Here, and she goes on and on. Well, one day while her father was out, the Ramaz was out, the doorbell rang, and Item opened the door to admit Jacob H. Schiff. Jacob Schiff was a Reformed Jew. He normally attended Temple Emmanuel, obeying some atavistic impulse, however, when the time arrived for him to say his annual Kaddish or memorial prayer for the dead parents, he came to the Ramaz synagogue to do it. Mr. Schiff asked for the Ramaz. Ida invited him to have a glass of tea while he waited for her father. Mr. Schiff accepted, and according to Ida, found her so agreeable that he would come back one day and take her for a drive in the park. Finally, he departed, leaving a message. When the Ramaz returned, Ida expiated on Mr. Schiff's democratic manners. She was so dazzled by the vision of riding in the park between Jacob Schiff that she couldn't remember the message. When the Ramaz reproved her mildly, she said, don't worry, he'll be back any minute to take me for a ride. To which the Ramaz answered with a tired smile, Avada, an untranslatable expression in Yiddish that conveys a maximum of affirmation firmly laced with a maximum of skepticism. The skepticism was, as it turned out, justified. So we got to tell Mr. Schiff he owes this young daughter, Ida of the Ramaz, he owes her a ride in Central Park in his carriage. Yeah, it's like someone coming to you today and say, I'm going to take you for a ride in my Rolls Royce. All right? Could you picture? Oh, boy, if I was in a Rolls Royce, I wish my grandchildren and great-grandchildren would be around to see the covet that their great-grandfather is being treated to. Now, she describes also her husband died. In other words, Ida, the aunt, the original, the man that was really the uncle by blood of the lady writing this memoir. So she now marries a second time. Who does she marry? A Mr. Newman from Newark. A marriage that Ida claims she could never account for. Her detachment about this marriage may be gathered from the fact that after he died, this is her second husband died, she was asked why she did not wear mourning for him. She replied airily, quote, for my father, for my sister, for my mother, I will wear black, but what should I wear for a total stranger? Got it? Oh boy, oh boy. Ellie, don't laugh too hard. I'm going to ask your wife, 50 years from now, are you a total stranger or her better half? Okay, and we'll get the answer, but 50 years from now. Newman, who looked like Henry Pontiquer, whoever that was a tall, corpulent, imposing man with a small, trimmed, pointed white beard. He was pious and adored the Ramaz, whom he had tried to entice to the rabbinate in Newark. As he could not have the Ramaz in Newark, he came to New York to see the holy man as often as possible. And summers, when the Ramaz was at Bradley Beach, he took his idol out for drives in his automobile, which the Ramaz enjoyed very much. Newman, who had done well in real estate, was now retired. He devoted himself to good works. He had two ambitions, to visit Palestine and to visit in the company of the Ramaz. Listen to this. Newman had settled in Newark by mistake. When he arrived in the country as an immigrant in his youth, he disembarked at Baltimore. The boat landed at Baltimore. It was intention to go to New York, the only American city he had heard of. When the train reached Newark, however, he heard the conductor shouting what sounded to him like New York. And though he had arrived at his destination, and thought he had arrived at his destination, several months passed before he found out that he was not living in New York. Now I have to tell you in parentheses, remember my real rabbinate, the shul I built from scratch, the first Orthodox shul, was a suburb of Newark. Newark at one time in the 1910s, the 1920s, 1930s, was an Ir V'Ein B'Yisrael. The percentage of Shmirat Shabbat in Newark was higher than in New York City. You should be aware of that. Later, the problem with Newark was, unfortunately, tremendous machloket between the Rabbanim, one after another, the Agudas HaRabbanim, the Hechsherim, and by the 1950s, there wasn't a kid who didn't leave Newark and get involved with the conservative and then the reform movement. And the biggest temples in the world were in suburban Essex County. In 1962, a little kid came along by the name of Ani Rothkopf, and he built the first Orthodox shul, suburban Essex County. Today, in suburban Essex County, there's one major shul after another. Shabbos morning, you go through Essex County, there must be tens of thousands of Shomrei Shabbos going to the various shuls, including the family of the President of the United States. And it all goes back to a kid named Ani Rothkopf, 1962. We want to build an Orthodox shul in Maplewood. YU plants me there, drops me off there, and as they say, the rest is history. If anyone would ever told me that in my community, Milkwood, South Orange, there'd be an Erev today, I'd say, what are you, crazy? And Baruch Hashem, 60 years later, there is an Erev. Now, I want to tell you that Newman finally took Ramaz and his wife, Ramaz's daughter, Ida, and they visited Palestine. And the three of them, it was the greatest moment of their life. Now, she goes back and tells us a little bit about Ramaz, which we wouldn't know about had she not written this. The Ramaz was very young. He was referred to already as a tzaddik, as a saint. And he was a rabbi in Europe. In 1886, he decided to leave Europe and came to the United States, to the Baldwin Place Synagogue in Boston. He was married to his first wife at the time, a stately, pious, strong-minded young lady whom he adored and who was with him through all his early tribulations. They had two sons and two daughters. And he was very happy in America, but he was haunted by the thought, what will be with my children? Can I stay here? Is there a future? It's alien. It's too progressive. They're hustling all over. And believe it or not, he returned to Europe with his wife and his young children. He went back to his native town. He was ready to find the shtela, to take on a rabbanut in an area that he knew and understood and felt at home. But you see, you can't go back. I once saw a movie again. It made a big impression on me and my wife. We saw the movie on to 50 years ago. I don't even know the name of the movie. But it had such a powerful message. It was about a young couple they met in high school, a young couple in love. And they get married, and they struggle, and they move on, and they move out. And 10 years later, he has a good position, a good job, and they're able to afford the money to come back to where they were born and raised. And they're so excited, they're coming back, they're traveling. It's like Yomo going back to Kiev today to see the house where he was born, the streets where he lived, the shul he didn't go to at the time, etc. And then you get back. Who were you? No one knew you. They look at you. Stranger. You can't go back. He came back to Europe behind his back. They were poking fun at him. Knew what did they call him? A little bit Yiddish, Eli. The Americana. Did you understand that? The Americana. That's not complimenting you. That's looking down at you. Who the heck are you? You ran away. You went to America. You tasted the good life. The Americana hat zurück gekommen. The American came back again. So he picked up and left. He never, never returned again. Went back to the Baldwin Place synagogue. And as they say, the rest is history. Okay. Now, this chapter is very, very important. And I just want to state it on a historic level. And we'll come back to it in due course in the next few weeks. Shortly after the Ramaz returned to America, he and his wife sent their first son, who was then 9 years old, back to Lithuania to attend the Telz Yeshiva. Now, this was not that uncommon among people who really cared about educating their children. Those of you who eat Manischewitz matzah, be aware that Bernard Manischewitz, the founder of the firm in America over 120 years ago, sent his own sons, teenagers, to study in Yerushalayim, because he felt in America they could not get a good education. All right, Telz, 9 years old, is particularly young, but he was a mature boy, and Telz was not like all the other yeshivot. When we get to Telz, you'll understand they were considered the most innovative yeshiva in Europe. It's not like America. Telz in America, I still remember Rev Shmuel Lazer Volk, my last Rebbe before the Rav. I studied with him 2 years, and Adam Gadol, and Rev Shmuel Lazer Volk would get hysterical. Telz, this is nicht Telz, das ist Amerikaner. A joke. He would come, he'd jump up and down. He was hysterical. All right, he couldn't handle what happened in Telz in America. He remembered Telz. Telz had a high school, a gymnasium. Could you imagine? Telz was like Yeshiva University. Telz had a school for girls, for women, Yavna. It was unheard of in Europe. Reb Lazer Gordon was a gomon idea, but very open. No, tell me what happened when Reb Moshe Soloveitchik got married. No, who was there? Who was there? No, one second. Jay, you have the invitation. No, Reb Moshe, you have to the Reb's wedding. Not the Reb Moshe. Reb Moshe got married. Was Yitzchak Rubin there? No, I want to know. Raketet was there. I was absolutely there. Dove, one way, you know, was there. Read the memoir literature. Reb Chaim invited, his son is getting married, Reb Pujana's daughter. Reb Chaim invited all the Gedolei Yisrael. He didn't invite the Telz Rav, Reb Lazer Gordon, who was a Gadol Shebegdol, because Reb Chaim had a kapeta on him. What was he upset with? The Telz Rav introduced the idea, they were going back to the last 2 centuries ago, the idea of having a daily religious newspaper. The world is starting to change. 1880s, 1890s, people are reading newspapers. It's not like the Lubavitcher Rebbe cracked the joke. He said, everyone is upset with me. This is the early 70s at the Yutet Kislev Fabrengen. So they brought me a tape of the Fabrengen. I'm very, very in debt to Manny Hosa. So he recorded it from the radio. It was already on the radio in New York. So the Rebbe said he had introduced the idea of Kol Ein Vabat Madlikat Neirat Shabbat. Every girl, even if she's not, it's an ingenious idea, even if she's not married, has to light Shabbos candle. Light one candle she lights with her mother. Mother lights two, she lights one. But give a girl a mitzvah that is her mitzvah. And then instead of putting on tefillin, she's lighting Shabbos candles. So people criticize the Rebbe. First of all, it's not so simple that a girl shouldn't light Shabbos candles. Look into the Aruch HaShulchan. But people criticize the Rebbe. So the Rebbe said, what do they want out of me? He says, who read a newspaper 100 years ago? How did the Jews get the news? And the Rebbe described the dorf outside the shul, the courtyard. I mean, he sits in Chotzer, and Chaim Yankel got gehet from a Goyish doctor. He went to a Gentile doctor who told him some news that he read in a German newspaper. And 50 people gathered around Chaim Yankel to hear the news that was 3 months old. He says, nowadays, who doesn't read a daily newspaper? Why are they criticizing me? I innovate. And this, where were we with the newspapers? This was Ramaz. He came back. He was the Americana. He had tasted of the new life. They poked fun at him. And this was Reb Lazer Gordon. He wanted a new newspaper in Europe. A daily newspaper. He was a harbinger. He was a forerunner of what's going to happen with Agudat Yisrael afterwards. And Rav Chaim Brisker, a noisvav, a trompenik, a pushtak. Ellie, that doesn't lend itself to translation. Please, don't raise your hand now. And you with me, Herb? And this is Rav Chaim. And here, you're looking at gentlemen from Boston who grew up on the feet of his grandson. What a difference. And the Rav always told you, Rav Chaim and the continuation and Mesorah. And yet the Rav, on certain levels, was a new Maimer Hasina. Yitzchak, right or wrong? Right or wrong? Unbelievable. Rakefet makes a living out of it, but we'll leave those lectures for another time back here. So, Reb Lazer Gordon was traveling, and he heard that Reb Chaim's son is getting married to Reb Elia Pruzhana. How can it be? I'm not going to be at the wedding. Kamsa ba Kamsa, the Gemara in Gittin. He came to the wedding, uninvited. When Reb Chaim saw that Reb Lazer Gordon came, he was mechabatim with Siddur Kedushin. He knew this is the Adam Gadol. All right, he has this, that doesn't agree with him hashkafically, but this was tells. It was different. And could you imagine, they sent a 9-year-old kid, now I have no reason to doubt that this is correct, she writes, she proofread, a 9-year-old kid to Tells. Alright, the boy was precocious and devout. He received smicha when he was 13 years old. A conspicuously early age for such an attainment. Then he came back to America, went to public school, and later to Harvard, where he had a brilliant career as a student. Directly after his graduation from Harvard, he was called to the rabbinate of the leading Orthodox synagogue of Cleveland. Underline that word, Orthodox synagogue of Cleveland. In 1917, at the age of 36, he was killed in an automobile accident. He was not even married. That tragedy affects all of Torah history in the United States. It would have been a different story. He was killed. We'll talk about it. You'll see in a week or two. The Ramaz traveled to Cleveland to bring his son's body back to New York. He delivered the Hesperah eulogy in his own synagogue. Those who heard it say that the Ramaz's quiet voice and bearing, through it they found comfort and reassurance. Many wept. The Ramaz did not weep. His son, he said, had some identification with the divine. The identification he himself had all his life striven to find. His son had found it, and perhaps in his youth and vigor more clearly than even his own father. He had, moreover, made the necessity for it to clear some of his parishioners, and thus his own vision was perpetuated. In other words, the influence he had on some of the Balabatim, This made his life significant and imperishable. All right, that's quite a description, quite a story. Cleveland, the Ramaz's son, Rabbi Samuel Margolis, young man, Tel Smicha, Harvard graduate, to die so young in a car accident, and that takes me back to Rakefet. Well, what am I talking about, Ellie? What do you mean it takes me back to Rakefet? How many times have you heard me say, instead of demonstrating against computers, we should demonstrate against cars? Millions have been killed by cars. Tens of millions. God have mercy. In Israel, every day we hear sadness. Get cars off the highway. 100%. The computer can entice you, but you can overcome it. You're still alive. But when a car kills you, you are dead. And it's a sad, sad little story. You see the implications. And I can give you an analogy. Yitzchak, there's an election this Tuesday, tomorrow. That election goes back to a bus that ran over a Jew in Rehov Shiftei Yisrael, in Meir Sharim. The Rehov that becomes Meir Sharim, Rehov Meir Sharim. What's it called on the other side? Am I right? Shiftei Yisrael? Malchei Yisrael. Shiftei Yisrael is over. Yeah. Malchei Yisrael. That's what I was looking for. No, Yitzchak, 1980s. A tragedy happened right there, early 90s. That's why we have the election tomorrow. No? Anyone understand what I'm saying? The Gera Rebbe at that time of Sin Kabunim had one son who was married. This son, among many others, but this son was married to Reb Menashe Klein's daughter. This son was an Adam Gadol. A giant. He had the best mind of anyone in the Gera dynasty post-World War II. And he had been born here, raised here, had an understanding of Israel, and a bus ran him over. He would have been Gera Rebbe. Had he become Gera Rebbe, you would not have the elections Tuesday. You know, understand what I mean. These elections are a result of the Gera Rebbe, who created Avigdor Liebman and all that goes with it. And it's sad, but that's life. Sometimes something happens. You don't realize what the implications are 40, 50 years later because of that bus running over such a great Jew on Rehov Malchei Yisrael. We have elections tomorrow. Same thing here. You'll see what happens. He dies. Sad. All right, let me end off the memoir on a lighter note. That's what's so beautiful. It's a human being. When the Ramaz's third wife died, Ida took the death as a reflection on her own ability. Now, what does this mean? Ida never had to work for a living. All her two husbands were wealthy. But she indulged in shidduchs, shidduchim. This was her ballpark, to make shidduchim. And Ida had made the shidduch for the third wife of her father, and he died, and she died right afterwards. She took the death as a reflection on her own ability. She determined that the next one must have a doctor's certificate. She did not really want to leave. She was living with her daughter, Gogo. That was the daughter's name. It's the Upper East Side now. She didn't want to leave her daughter's house. She loved where she was living. And she would have to send out so many cards to announce her new telephone number. Let us that she acted with dispatch. In fact, she married her father off without leaving Gogo's apartment. She referred to this coupe as the window marriage. Ida was sitting by a window reading when a window in the opposite apartment opened. You know, today's generation can't understand this. Everyone has a house today. We grew up in my building alone. There was a front, a back. There were 54 different families. Ida was sitting by a window reading when the window was open, and a nice-looking gray-haired woman addressed her across the narrow alleyway. No, do you remember Molly Goldberg? Thinking of Molly Goldberg, of course. Dearie, I heard that your father's wife died, she said. I would like an introduction. Morty, you walked in at the high point. Are you pious, Ida asked? I am pious, but for your father, I could become more pious. Are you healthy, Ida asked? I never had a sick day. I had in mind the Boston woman, Ida said. Why should he go to Boston when I am right here? I will let you know, Ida said. She informed the father that there was a beautiful woman next door. Notice, she's telling the Ramaz, a men, a mensch like the mensch. Don't wave this away. And by the way, it's interesting, not to offend any of the Ungarische here, you notice the Polish Rebbeim were all married to beautiful women. It's unbelievable. And the Ungarische, skinny, eisgetricken, it's interesting. They really were tzaddikim evidently. They didn't look at women. But the Polisha, they looked, they knew. The Litvisha, oh boy. And she says, there was a beautiful woman next door who has always greatly admired him and who has asked nothing more of life than to be the wife of the Ramaz. She then had a doctor examine the woman, and he reported that her heart was good. The marriage took place. This is wife number four. Before long, the woman became ill. Ida called the doctor. I thought you said her heart was good. Her heart is good, said the doctor. But her lungs are nicht so good. I'm not so good. After my mother, Ida used to say sadly, Papa never had any luck with his wives. Actually, however, the Ramaz's fourth wife did survive him. All right, this is beautiful, a beautiful memoir. Beautiful memoir. With the rocket shove news on the Cheren, by the way, they say his wife was a beauty. There's memoir literature. There's memoir literature of, I think it was Professor Kahana from London, Copal Kahana, went to visit him and he couldn't get over it. Yeah, go ahead, what were you talking?
I know someone who spent Shabbos with him.
Right.
Personally.
Right.
And they said it was a very, very ugly woman.
Right, okay.
And they asked him, how could you do this? He says, she kind of, she shot, she ran
up. Right.
So he says, I was raised in the house which is very tzedua. I never saw a woman. I thought they all looked that way.
All right, I don't know. I remember reading, I tried to think, I think it's Kapil Kahana, that he actually visited and he was amazed, and the rocket shovel was so unworldly, he would say them, we'll take it either way. I thought they all looked that way. Interesting. And there's there's the film on, 20 years ago already, the documentary on Borough Park, A People Apart, I think it's called. And there you'll see this kid from his mother made the shidduch for him, and he thanks his mother for making a shidduch with such a beautiful girl. And it's very moving because you see how he totally depended on his mother. It takes me back to what I said yesterday in class. Bring back the shidduch system. It works better than what we have. And boy, wherever I walk, wherever I go, I hear this divorce, that divorce. And when it's among your own students, I have to remember, I already have students who are married three times, not just twice. Got to remember the first husband, the second, the third, and when shall I them. Let's move further. All right? So this is the Ramaz. This is the background of Joe Lookstein. This is where he's coming from. This is the great influence on him. Now, his greatest achievement, and I don't know if we'll reach it today, but you'll see. Anyone from Boston will have to bow their heads to Joe Lookstein. His greatest achievement was the Ramaz School. And here, you come to an interesting dilemma in life. Some of the greatest schools in the world from the Torah point of view have been organized for one simple reason. Because there's a boy who has to be educated. You take Yeshiva College. Yeshiva College comes into the world for many good reasons. Among them, Rabbi Bernard Revel, my cousin, had two sons who had to be educated, Norman and Heschel. They are members of Yeshiva College's first graduating class. Boston, Maimonides, so many Maimonides graduates sitting in this room at this moment in time. How did Maimonides come about? Because the Rav had a son named Chaim, and Chaim had to be educated. Figure it out. How did Ramaz come about? Because Joseph Lichtenstein had a son, and that son had to be educated. And that's how Ramaz comes about, 1937. Joe DiMaggio's second year in the major leagues. That's how you can remember the year that Ramaz was organized. Organized, Kilat Jeshurun, 37, affiliated with the shul. You'll see it plays a big role. Now, what we take for granted, all right, he organized the yeshiva. What's the big deal? We don't realize what the times were like. Rabbi Senior Lichtenstein's son, Haskell, had an older sister, Natalie. Joe Lichtenstein and his wife, his Rebbetzin Gertrude, who I yet knew, wonderful people, they wanted to organize a school for Natalie already. Why should women be second rate? Natalie was a number of years older, and Joe Lichtenstein could not pull it off. And there were many reasons. Number one, and this is a reflection of what the Rav will say about Boston, the Jew himself, who remained Shomer Shabbos, was very frightened of a yeshiva, a parochial school. The kids would grow up without the ability to speak a proper English.
That's exactly what the neighbors told my mother. No, Don't send the child to Ramani's, he'll grow up uneducated.
Will not speak a proper English. This was the fear.
And my mother, who's your side, is Friday. I don't know how she did it. She withstood a peer group and the fact that my mother is charged.
Right.
School's free.
I'm the same story. When my mother switched me from public school to yeshiva, she had a bargain with them. I think it was $5 a month she had to pay. And it was, my father had limited income. He was a postman. My father was scarred. My parents were scarred by the Depression. My father never wanted to leave the post office because he had security there. It's not going to go out of business, but what they paid. And it's a miracle. Look, we sit here and, I don't want to speak, but my brother and I are doing our share. We have a wedding tonight. My brother has a granddaughter getting married. Her father is also a student of mine, a sub-student who I always quote in class, Dr. Zev Rothkopf, the famous dentist. And out of my going to yeshiva, my mother working it out, there are hundreds upon hundreds of souls, almost all in Israel. We do have a branch in Borough Park and in Las Vegas. It's all part of that same branch of the family. All Shomrei Torah mitzvah. It's beyond words. And my brother's family, my family, Kanai Nara. Don't want to boast, but my brother's family, I can tell you, either they're big in learning or big in the army. There's no phoniness there. If you're learning, you're learning. Fine, so you do a minimum of army. If you're not learning, you're a career man in the army. And Kanayin Hara, I have my first career officer right now, beginning right now. My youngest grandson, who just got married, career officer with Anatudai. I remember I told you in Technion, and he won $1,000 for a project he did in his senior year. They came in from Switzerland. Everything was conducted in English. Thank God he thanks his parents and his grandparents that we spoke English to him. And when he won the $100,000, I said, you know something, I won a $50 bond when I graduated college from my research in American Jew. Remember I told you the Center Relief Committee? So I asked the student to check it out on the computer, who won more? And my $50, circa 1958, is equal to $940 today. So my grandson beat me by $60. And I quoted the Gemara to him, Ein Av B'Kaneh B'Vno, V'Ein Rav B'Kaneh M'Talmido. But you won't speak English, you won't be an American. And these people, they were frum, but as the Rav said, they had no confidence, they had no self-confidence, they had no vision. And they were worried stiff about a day school, a yeshiva. This is a second factor. We're talking about the 1930s. What did I just say to you? My mother and father went to their graves bearing the outcome of the Depression. My father was offered many times. He had friends, childhood friends, good people, come into business with us, Max. You make a living. Couldn't do it. Wouldn't hear of it. Wouldn't leave. It's like, why you? I was offered by another institution. They said, we will pay you 2 times what YU is paying you. We don't care what YU is paying you. You have to tell us. 2X. And I answered, I was born in YU, I was raised in YU, I taught in YU, I lived in YU, I wrote in YU, I will die in YU. Money will not take me out of it. I'm a depression, and YU is the same, it's a syndrome. All right, Baruch Hashem. In my case, it's a happy syndrome. My mother had money in 10 different banks. I said, Mom, what are you crazy? Why all these banks? She said, Arnie, don't you understand if there'll be a depression again? She was limited. I think you could take out only $10. I don't know. Check it out. 1931, 32. You were limited what you could take out of the bank. But if you had an account in 10 different banks, you could get out $100. 10 times 10. She, all her life, I couldn't believe my ears. Limited, shimmered. I mean, in Israel, if the banks go under, the whole country goes under. If there'll be a country, there'll be banks. And when did Lukstein want to organize? It was the depression fallout. And even the big shots in his community, but they were scarred. A yeshiva, a new budget, a new responsibility, a new need for money for charity. Rabbi, be realistic. Okay. I have to give credit now to a blood relative of mine. His family never acknowledged our existence because we were the poor part of the family. But when the Rothkopf boys made a bit of a reputation, I'm not talking about my brother, the world famous medical doctor, suddenly they are now, alright, I admit I'm a little bit of a... Vic told me, I'm a rock star, all right? His family told him, I gave a lecture, his family, that your Rebbe's a rock star. Now they acknowledged the relationship. But Max Etra, it's because of Max Etra that Namaz exists. Ellie, did you ever hear the name Max Etra? Make believe you did, so the ignorant pass for the wise, darn it. Max Etra, who signed your diploma when you graduated college? He was Max Etrick. He was president of the yeshiva. He signed every diploma. I told you Max Etrick, many stories about him. They were very successful in business, the Etrick brothers. There's a very famous lawyer on the West Coast that's Max Etrick's nephew. That's the nephew that Bush, the second president Bush, was very pro-Israel and pro-Jewish. Like Trump, he also made statements he can't understand how people are reform and conservative and not proper Jews. The story is very simple. His roommate in, where was it, Harvard, Yale, what were they, Yale, I think the Bushes were Yale, his roommate was Etra. And occasionally Etra would invite him home for Shabbos, spend the Shabbos in New York with us, and Bush saw a family with love, with devotion, with Yiddishkeit, etc. And this Donald Etra was so close to Bush, knew, you know the story, it's no secret. Whenever he came to Washington on legal business, he stayed at the White House. Bush said, no, you don't go to any hotel. We roomed together, I slept in your house, you now sleep in my house. And he only, and whenever he came to Washington, he would contact the ambassador, Israeli ambassador, what should I mention to the president? And he would get a briefing what to mention, so it wouldn't be a Shabbat in vain. So Max Etra never married. That's the story. Let me tell it to you again, put it into context now. That's the story in the 1940s when Joe Lookstein was getting 30, 40 people Shabbos morning. Hard to believe today. You're getting thousands. Various minyanim. But in the 40s, after World War II, the Frum people couldn't afford, the refugees couldn't yet afford to live on the Upper East Side. No, the Upper East Side was totally assimilated. You got 30, 40 Jewish Shabbos. It was a miracle. So Lookstein wanted to activate, so he came up with the idea of, instead of the women going up two stories to the woman's balcony, to bring the women downstairs and put a mechitza downstairs. And he meets with the board of trustees and, Rabbi, whatever you want, if it's halachically okay, you're the boss, fine. The next morning, Max Etra says to him, Rabbi, I have to tell you, you can go ahead with your plans, but I'll be leaving the shul. So Lookstein starts shaking. Max Etra leaves the shul, millions of dollars are walking away. Says, Max, you voted in favor. Rabbi, I went home, and you know I take care of my mother, and I told my mother what you intend to do, and my mother said, Ich ken nicht stabenen in azah shul. Das ist nicht wie die alte Chaim. Translation, I cannot daven in such a shul. It's not like the one in the old country. And Joe Lookstein had to back off, so Max Etra would remain in the shul. This was Max Etra, a heart of Yiddishkeit, very good to his mother, so good that he himself never married. Gave his life to Tzedakah, his life to klal work, but above all, single-handedly, took care of his mother. This is, you gotta give credit, it's a life situation, it's not a happy conclusion, but it's a valid decision. When Joe Lookstein insisted, we're going to open up Ramaz, and the Balabatim were hesitant, and they won't be Americans, they won't be modern, and Max Etra got up and said, Rabbi, what do you think the deficit in the budget for the shul will be for the first year of the yeshiva? And Lookstein said, I estimate $6,000. This is 1936, 1937 money. Max said, go ahead, Rabbi. I'll guarantee whatever deficit up to $6,000. And that's the way Ramaz began. And you gotta give him tremendous credit. Max J. Etra, a prominent attorney and lay leader in the congregation, pledged to cover the first year's deficit, which the rabbi estimated, let me correct myself, would be $5,000. Now, let me tell you what I'm quoting from. I'm quoting from a volume that came out about the life of Haskell Lookstein, Rav Chesed. The life and times of Rabbi Haskell Lookstein by Rafael Medoff, M-E-D-O-F-F, not to be confused with a very similar name that brought great shame to the Jewish people. This is Rafael Medoff. He has published quite a number of books in American Jewish history, and this was an in-house work on Hacky Lookstein, on Ramaz, on KJ of today. Now, here too, you see what I said earlier in today, and Lookstein named the school after Rabbi Margolis, a renowned scholar from Vilna, whose intellectual feats included studying the complete Talmud every year. In other words, Ramaz was privileged to be able to be chozer on the Gemara once a year. All right? How many of us can do that? It takes me, I make a cheshbon, I'm going through Shas a third time, it takes me 15 years to go through Al-Hadaf with the Mefarshim, Rishonim, once a year. Their other Gedolim could do it 30 days, once a month, go through Shas. But okay, this is Ramaz. Significantly, this is what we said before, the Ramaz was also known for substantial involvement in communal affairs. A famous photograph shows Rabbi Margolis participating in the founding meeting of the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, the overseas relief agency run primarily by non-Orthodox Jews, should say by German Reform Jews. Warburg, Schiff, others, Osiris Adler was a Shemi Shabbos. He was different. He was identified with the seminary, he was the second president, but he personally was a Shemi Shabbos. His willingness to work side by side with Jews of other backgrounds and different levels of religious observance was emblematic of a spirit of tolerance for which his grandson, meaning Joe Lookstein, and great-grandson, meaning Haskell Lookstein, would become well known. On page 4 of the volume, you have the key. How did Hacky get the name Haskell? Everyone calls him Hacky. Haskell. How many other rabbis do you know named Haskell? I think, to my knowledge, RCA may have over 1,000 members today, Rabbinical Council of America. I don't believe there's a second Haskell. In 1932, shortly before son was born, Rabbi Joe Lookstein visited the Ramaz to receive a blessing. As the story goes, Rabbi Margolis had just read about the passing of Rabbi Chatzkel Yecheskel Kalisha, a distinguished scholar with whom Ramaz had been close. This is Europe, the Europeisha Rav from the Kalisha family. He suggested to Rabbi Lookstein that the baby be named Haskell, and quote, this is Ramaz speaking, so that he grow up to be like Reb Haskell. Lookstein was pleased with the idea, regarding it as a harbinger of success for his son, but he worried that his wife and mother, meaning his wife, Gertrude, the mother of Hacky, would be less than thrilled about naming him after some Polish rabbi instead of a relative. And just let me interrupt here. Minig Yisrael, who gets the name of the first child born in a family? The mother gets the name. That is Minig Yisrael. The Rav would tell the story 1,000 times over. Rakefet quotes it in his work on the Rav, where the rabbi said, no, you should ask God, I'm living it in Yiddish and I'm breaking my teeth in English to make Ellie happy. Ellie, you should ask, how am I called Joseph Dove? It's named after my great-grandfather on my father's side. My mother should have the name. Good question. What did the Rav answer? Are you familiar with Rakepin's work on the Rav? You don't know it by heart, Ellie? What are we wasting our life on? 2 and 2 is 4? That'll survive with or without you. Ah, the Rav answered, Rav Chaim came to Rebbetzin Pesha. And Rav Chaim said, Rebbetzin, you know, I'm never santek out of bris. I can't handle the sight of blood. But if you name the boy after my father has no one named after him in the family, I'll be the tzaddik." And Rebbetzin Pesha agreed, and Reb Chaim was the tzaddik at the Rav's bris. He tolerated the blood, and Moriah Rebbe was named Reb Yosef Dov Halevi, ben Reb Moshe. And here, so what do you do now to convince the wife? They conspired on some of these words. This is Ramaz and Rabbi Joe Lichtstein. They conspired to present the name as connected to Ramaz's father and uncle, both of whom were called Jeheskel. Gertrude Lichtstein accepted the proposal, but planned to give him Charles as his English name. Rabbi Lichtstein objected. "You're going to call the boy Charles? We want him to become a great rabbi, and they're going to give him a nickname. Charles in English is Chuck. Chuck. You know, I know Chuck's. Chuck Solomon, you know Chuck Solomon is a Canadian." Their compromise solution was to use the slightly Americanized Haskell. Although the future Rabbi Lichtstein was immediately nicknamed Hack or Hacky by family and friends alike. And you see, this little episode, it reveals so much. On one hand, no one ever dreamt of calling a kid in the 1930s Yeheskel or Ezekiel in English. Too Jewish. Everyone had to have two different names. Take a look at my birth certificate. I got to think what I was called, all right? I'll recall it. Arnold Edward. My brother, Levi, Leonard Earl. My kid brother, Stephen Douglas. Rebbeinu Shel Olam. All right, my brother is Steve. I don't think he's ever used Douglas in his life. Lenny, no one even knows that's his real name, because he became Levi in Bnei Akiva, and Levi remained Levi. Arnold, yeah. Well, my wife is angry at me when I hear, she says, "Arnold, the minute I hear Arnold, I know I'm in trouble." You understand? Baruch Hashem Tov, I can handle it, don't get upset. But that's as much as Arnold plays a role. But Hacky Lichtstein, what's fascinating, the name Hacky caught on. And when Hacky was in Yeshiva, no one in the world ever referred to him as Haskell. Everyone knew him as Hacky.
What did the Rav call?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know. Did the Rav call? The Rav called me Arnold, that much I can tell you. But did the Rav call him Hacky or Haskell? I would imagine the Rav called him Haskell. I don't know yet. I'll end off the class. I'll give you a special gift. It's an absolute true story. Morty, 36,000 to the IOU list. A deal? You bought? Okay. Morty Tarragon has put 36,000. You know, the IOU list, Ellie, when the Rebbe tells you something special, if you get it for nothing, you treat it as it's worthless. The Gemara says, Asher Demegin Magen Shavya. A doctor who treats for nothing is worth nothing. You gotta feel you're getting something special, and believe me, you are. And the story is very simple. The Holzer family was very close to the Rav. Those from Boston, what Levovitz was to the Rav in Boston, Abe Levovitz, Manny Holzer was to the Rav in New York. Okay? So whenever the Holzer family had a Sheva Brachas, the Rav would speak, and some of his fabulous moments where he let his hair down were in the Holzer house where I just spoke, in that very room I spoke this past summer. And it's recorded, it's online. Rakefe quotes these talks in his work on the Rav. He would let his hair down because he felt totally at home. He was with his friends, B'toch Ami Ani Yoshev. So now they're picking the Rav up. The eldest Holzer boy is picking the Rav up and taking him to a Sheva Brachas of a younger brother. And the Rav says to him in the car, "And who will be at the Sheva Brachas?" And he starts telling him, you know, the Queen's Mafia, the Rabbanim, this rabbi, that rabbi. And then he says, "And Roy will be there." Uncle Roy. And the Rav, Uncle Roy, and all right, Rav didn't know who he meant. All right, one of the Rabbanim. About 10 years later, a Rav in the greater Queens area had heart trouble. I was in the hospital. And the Rav called the wife, you know, these people no longer alive, Rabbi Kowalski, called Shulamit, and he is Sunday morning, and Shulamit Kowalski answers the phone, and he says, Rebbetzin Kowalski, this is Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. How is your husband? And she says, please, don't play games with me. Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. You're Roy Alpert. And then the Rav understood so many years later, he hears Roy, he put two and two together, that Uncle Roy was Yitzchak Alpert. That was his nickname. All the kids, all the family, everyone called him Roy Alpert. You follow? But so many years later, the Rav remembered what went on in the car and who will be there, and Uncle Roy will be there. And the Rav calls, and imagine, she says that, by the way, I inverted the story. The story with Shulamit happened first, and she said, Roy, don't play games with me. And all the years, the Rav wondered, who is this Roy? What's she talking about? And 10, 15 years later, in the car, going to the Sheva Brachos, he says, Uncle Roy, what do you mean? Who do you mean, Uncle Roy? Rabbi Albert, we all call him Uncle. Oh, Yitzchak Albert. And then the Rav said, Yetz Vashteach, now I understand what Shulamit Kowalski said to me so many years ago. So, all right, that was the Rav. Those are nicknames, Hacky, Haskell, that's how he got the name. This is Rabbi Luxtein, this is Ramaz. This is a great achievement. And next week we'll understand what we talk about when we say a great achievement, to use modern Hebrew, the establishment of Ramaz Hafach Galim. It created waves all over the United States. And the person who benefited the most from Ramaz was a Jew in Boston by the name of Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik. And I'll quote to you his words, syllable by syllable. So to reiterate, one second, we have a lot to give out, but to reiterate, very fascinating, Ramaz, the memoir, the daughter, the four wives. On a more serious vein, the son, Samuel Gordon, the Mismach of Tells, very important, as we will see. Ramaz, the openness, Magnus's PhD thesis on the Kehillah, published afterwards by Columbia University. Very interesting, very sad how we could never get together. It's 100 years ago. Missionaries in Europe, is it true? Isn't it true? Go and prove what the fight was. Velvel Magolis, Knesset HaRabbanim versus the Agudas HaRabbanim, and these are Jews. We're living it tomorrow. As far as I know, there are three different parties running for people like myself who are religious Zionists. Three different parties. Two of them may be wasting every vote they get. But these are Jews, Ein Malasat. And this is Haki, this is Ramaz, this is 1932. Next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, on Sunday, it begins very interestingly how this contemporary Sfadik Talmud Chacham is attempting to understand Reb Moshe. Because Reb Moshe remains a major difficulty. Meisit u'meidiach. From there, we head to Las Vegas. Okay. Next week, we pick up here, just where we left off, and we move on, we continue. Who wanted this about the broadcast with Chabad in the fight? Mike Schatz, who wanted this? Someone wanted wanted Mike Schatz.
Somebody said it's Samuel Gordon.
Shmuel Gordon was his name, I believe. We'll come to it.
Not Margolis?
I'm saying Samuel Gordon because I know.
Shmuel
Margolis. Thank you, Jack. This I spoke about yesterday. I can't believe no one wanted it. This is the latest issue of Truman, the article that has caused such a storm. Are you allowed to eat in a vegan restaurant in Chutz Laaretz? If anyone wants it, this is the whole article with the footnotes and all that goes with it. Here's a very interesting piece on someone trying to establish Reb Moshe's Feinstein and how you can judge what Reb Moshe thought about of the people he writes to by the titles he gives them. Very interesting what people are doing research on. These are two Chabad Jews who just died recently, and they're Mesirat Nefesh, the story with Russia. One winds up in America, one in Israel, but it's inspiring what Chabad did and the Mesirat Nefesh that goes on until today. Here's a piece on the Jewish Center by Zev Elif. It appeared in some volume of the Jewish Center in honor of, I believe, 100 years. Oh, and this deals with Herman Wouk and how, who just died, and how Rabbi Young played a big role in his Yiddishkeit. If anyone is interested, this is from Kfarim. I think I told you Kfarim website went on the map because of my Shayurim here. Someone got interested in the names I'm mentioning. And believe it or not, this Kfarim is about my great uncle, Reb Yitzchak Rothkopf, and they have him here from my book when I write about him and other things, and I just sent them pictures this morning of my whole family, that part of the family. This is an unbelievable piece on the $430 mission. It's a reporter from Maariv who goes to the Rebbe. I knew Reb Naftali Krauss, he just died a year ago. And the Rebbe gave him dollars to give out when he goes back to Maariv and to all the workers. And when he comes back, the head of Maariv says, at that time it was a communist empire here. Gentlemen, it was a communist empire and you couldn't have dollars, you weren't allowed to own dollars. So they got special permission from the government to give out to each worker a $1 bill from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Now, 430 workers accepted the dollars. 4 workers refused. Got it? That's like Barak's mother with the mezuzah. Here is something that Jay sent me on Rav Soloveitchik and organizing. This is a year after I graduated college, 1960, late 59, organizing a branch of the Zionist movement in the yeshiva. And the Rav Paskind as if to say it should be a religious Zionist branch, Mizrahi, not general Zionist. Anyone who went to Har Etzion, here's the latest update and everything happening in the yeshiva and in Migdal Oz. Very fascinating, and this was all created. Yitzchak, this was all created by Rabbi Aaron Cutler's family. Are you aware of it? Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, Rabbi Huda Amital is married to Rabbi Zalman's granddaughter. And I told them that in Lakewood. Now, had Rabbi Aaron, no one argued with me, had Rabbi Aaron come to Israel, it would have been a different story.
They just lost their dedicated chairman, we should note.
What do you mean he lost?
David Landes was nifter.
Oh, David Landes. Where was he from, David Landes?
From Teaneck.
From Tim. And very chairman. I didn't know that. How old the man?
61.
60, young. If anyone's interested, here is a historic piece on the history of the rabbinate in Finland. What makes this very special to me is Reb Shimon Federbusch was the principal of Solanta when I first went to Solanta. Very interesting piece. Reb Yitzchak Glaser was in St. Petersburg. Reb Nali Amstam was in Helsinki. That's correct. This is very fascinating. Ashrei Shezachinu, New York is revoking its ban on conversion therapy. It seems many religious institutions, not Jewish, are going to the Supreme Court, And the feeling legally is there's no way the Supreme Court could upheld the ban on conversion therapy. So that helps us, it helps Chabad and the people working in it. This is fascinating too, from the New York Times. Cable cars over Jerusalem. Big machloket, what do we turn Jerusalem into? A Disney world. They want to build a cable car to the Kotel. This is fascinating. Missouri Attorney General refers 7 Catholic clergy for prosecution. Thank God YU was off the headlines. The same story. Gentlemen, the Ark of Hestat, that's Rabbi Deutsch, Borough Park. He has an ark built by the army after World War II that has one of the first shuls opened in the DP camps. And the ark is now being auctioned off. If anyone's interested, they need the money for keeping the museum he runs going. He hates to part with it, but for a few million dollars, it has an air bidding price, $1 million to $2 million. The beautiful article on the Rebbe talking to a Malamed, what you have to accomplish with your students, and the Malamed says to the Rebbe, you have many helpers who can help you in this daunting task, but I am one person, how can I succeed? The Rebbe answered him, the secretaries are only of help until the doorstep. Here I am alone. Very, very powerful. This is Russia, the Jews, the Mesirat Nefesh. This is magnificent. A Galician chassid came to the Rebbe and said to him, if you put on a shtreimel, you'll have every chassid in the world will become your chassid. And the Rebbe answered, let those Hasidim who wear shtreimels stay where they are. They're in a good place. I don't want them. Ani rotza Hasidim sheyavoh me'ashoma hatzeir umei hakibutzim. And here's a beautiful picture of 3 Shoma Hatzeir kids, what they looked like when they were finished with the army and what they look like today. Beautiful, beautiful message here. Another Chabad, Ben Sion Edelman, first Hasidic Jew growing up in Chemish, Williamsburg, ever to attend Harvard Law School. There he is with his wife, Harvard Law School. Edelman, interesting if he's not related to the famous Edelman Chabad family. Here's an unbelievable conversation between the Satmar Rav and the Tashbe Rebbe, and they're debating Zionism, and you have to read it word by word. The Tashbe Rebbe, who I never heard of before, was fabulous. And finally, here is a Michlala publication, what's going on in Michlala, and I was very, very moved, because on page 32, they're interviewing this head of the department, and she's now retiring, stopping to teach. And on page 32, she recalls her days in Michlala, and she speaks, Ani bogeret ha-michlala, v'zakhiti l'umod etzal Rav Kupman zetzal, v'etzal Professor Gross zetzal, v'yibadel l'chaim tovim v'aruchim ha-rav rakefet, v'yod rabim v'tovim. And I wrote her a note thanking her for remembering me, because it's so many years ago, it's moving. She studied me in the 70s. And she remembers me, and remember, I could barely speak Hebrew then. I felt sorry. I look back and think, gee, was I able? I taught in Hebrew, right? I guess I managed. I served in the army. I worked for the Mossad in Hebrew. And Baruch Hashem, I taught Hebrew to my great-grandchildren if I have to. So we're doing okay. The truth is that nowadays I'm more at home than in Hebrew than in English. You know, you can tell when I walk into this building, you know what happens, Ellie? Kids say to me, good morning, and I automatically answer, Boker Tov u'mevorach. First, I just want to thank everyone for coming, Mori. I just want to talk with you about our date and our friend, and until we meet again in health and happiness. Das vidanya.
Okay. So the story goes, you were mentioning about davening, how long it takes.